Joe, you started off with, in the Rainbow Valley back in 1988, and could you tell us when you went to the land, what it looked like, and the progression to how it is now?
Yes, it was quite a challenge when we looked at the land because it was quite a typical rundown property or old farm, and it has had a lot of gorse on it, of course, about 20 acres. So it was quite depressing looking at it, and the history of the land was quite a typical one for New Zealand. The land is hilly up here, it's in heavy clay soils, and what happened, it was covered, rainforest cover on it, and the early pioneers cut down the rainforest and took off actually the fertility of the land because the soil under rainforest is quite poor. So they took the good timber out first, the puri, kauri, and the totaras for fencing, and then they burned the hills off, and the result, of course, was heavy erosion. So the little bit of topsoil that there was up on those hills got washed out 100 years ago into the harbour and into the sea. So for me, it was quite a challenge to turn it around, and after 18 years now, it looks quite different.
Yes, a lot of kudos from a lot of people coming in to say just what a wonderful change and transformation, Joe. So what are you running in the form of, or what plants, what trees, what animals? Can you tell us?
I can briefly outline what I do here.
Please.
Permaculture farming is actually a very diverse system. We believe in greatest diversity that is possible because we're very holistic thinkers. And we say that, an ecological system is only strong if it's very diverse, because if certain elements or certain species fall over, you always have other things to pick up. So permaculture design is relying on this diversity. So I started off collecting plants, from all over the world, and lucky me here with this beautiful Northland climate here, I can grow practically, all the Northern Hemisphere plants, and then the Mediterranean plants. And lucky us here, we have a lot of subtropicals growing, and some of them doing better and better because we're actually getting higher temperature, probably due to global warming. It looks like I've been taking records here now for 18 years, and it's getting warmer and warmer. But otherwise, it is also extremer weather-wise. So the plants are amazing array and interesting stuff growing together. You wouldn't believe it. I have a prune here from Siberia, and it's only about 5 meters growing away from a fig tree from Portugal.
Yes.
So that's wonderful.
So when you go out into your grounds, what time do you start your day, Joe?
Oh, daybreak. Really an early riser, and I enjoy the morning, and the dawn chorus is really beautiful in our valley, and I get out very early and start working, and the work never ends. Of course, on a permaculture farm, you do a lot of manual labor, although I do have a little tractor and some little machines, but we also have set up the farm to be able to run without electricity and without fossil fuel. So in case we have a crisis one day, the farm still could keep on going, because I milk my cows by hand. Most of the orchard work and garden work is done by hand. Only forestry, of course, relies on the tractor because of the hard work. But otherwise, I'm set up really nice. We call it in permaculture appropriate technology. And I build little machines that run with a flywheel and with muscle power. And that always works. And the good news is also the whole farm is gravity fed with water from a spring. That means I have no pump. So the power goes off, and practically this region here is on tank water. And all the farms around me can't milk the cows, can't get any water. So it's quite a foolproof system that I built up over 18 years.
We need good examples like that, Joe. You'd call yourself a small permaculture farm, but you can sustain yourself, or you're building towards being able to live off it, because you have you teach workshops as well, so yes. this brings another finance. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, that's actually quite a strong leg of my farming activity here. I've got only 50 acres, 20 hectares, but I could perhaps not make a good living. I could live very simple, perhaps, just from farming and selling the surplus, what I do now at the local farmers market in Matakana. We have a fantastic farmers market. It's only 1 year old, but a total success story. And I believe very much in community-supported agriculture. And we can talk a little bit more about that if you want. But the education is a very important part of my farming here, because I do teach permaculture also overseas. In winter, I go to Europe or to Asia, to Japan, and teach permaculture there. But on the farm, we have an interesting summer program of courses, workshops, and guided tours, and we have practically all the universities coming here, and the polytechs and other schools and colleges and kindergartens. So it's a wonderful interaction with the public, and we've done this for nearly 18 years now.
And what is your focus at present with your teaching, Joe?
Yeah, at the present, of course, is oil peak is a big issue, and losing our cheap energy, and then the resistance, you know, the drainage resistance, and then the build-up of toxins in the soil and water. These are the issues. I'm really focusing always to find the most sustainable ways of growing food. And I do a lot of research and trials here, like we're growing our own rice now. I've got a proper rice paddy where I grow rice. So far only for ourselves, but it has potential to spread in the warmer places of New Zealand. So I do a lot of experimentation that benefits the whole country later on once I'm sure it works. So yes, we do get lots of people, hundreds of people through the farm. And it's really wonderful. I enjoy this because it gives me really contact with the consumer in town. And I'm very concerned what happens to the rural and urban gap. You know, it's widening more and more. Factory farms or big farms do not allow people anymore on the land because of occupational safety and health and all the other regulations. It's too risky. So I'm very lucky to be able to open my farm for visitors. But of course, it's not easy. You have to be very careful and educate the people very well and make them aware of the dangers on the farm so nothing happens, because otherwise I would be in trouble with my education on the farm.
Well, I'm aware that you can't go into a poultry farm anywhere and have a look at the chooks and see the conditions, whereas I know that in a little farmlet like yours, you'd be able to go right into the fowl house, see where they lay their eggs, presumably in straw, and then see how they run, the chooks run outside in the grass and get rain and wind, and all these things, like having the freshness, I guess.
Mm. Oh, well, it's all natural farming what I do here. I give the animal the highest quality, the highest possible natural environment, so the animal is happy, stays healthy, and enjoys life. I would be a vegetarian otherwise. I could not eat the meat if I know the animal has suffered, and I consume actually meat that has this kind of energy, you know, the suffering and so on. So we only eat our own meat that comes off the farm, the chooks, ducks, geese, you know, guinea fowls, and peacocks, even anything gets eaten, because we believe in local consumption. We don't want any food miles. We don't want to consume any food miles. You're familiar with food miles, the transport of food before it gets eaten. I do a lot of teaching on that too, food mile analysis, and it's really a wake-up thing for consumers in the city if they realize they eat food from all over the world with thousands of kilometers on transport on it, and it's all with unrenewable fossil fuel, climate changing, and very destructive for the planet and totally unsustainable. So I promote very much locally grown food, consume it as close as possible to the growing or production place.
Yes, that hasn't really been looked at all, of course, with the World Trade Organization wanting coals to Newcastle. Is an old statement there that people... I know in England they sold 100,000 tonnes of cheese to Holland, and Holland sold 100,000 tonnes of cheese back to England, and they just changed things around slightly and kept their own produce.
Yeah, you just look at the Tasman trade here between Australia and New Zealand, the same products going back and forth. They meet somewhere halfway out in the Tasman Sea. It's crazy. And we only can do it now, but now we're losing the cheap energy, and we have to get real. Another thing that I teach is energy accounting. Energy is the embodied energy in all the products and activities. And I'm able now to put the energy accounting process on any product if necessary, and also on some activities. And it's quite shocking when you see how much we actually use on energy for very little outcome. So this is another thing that I teach people here, to be aware of the energy they have already in their product, you know, embodied. It's called energy.
I see, yes. Mm. It's like products for animals coming from such a food products coming for animals, where in actual fact you could grow your own turnips or chow mollia, or have... make your own hay or ensilage instead of trucking it in from the South Island or something like that?
Yeah, well, this is quite exciting when you know the embodied energy. For instance, one bag of cement has got about 15 litres of oil in it. And some milk in Europe, intensive milk production with housed animals, grain-fed, it's about 1 litre of fossil fuel now for 1 litre of milk. This is definitely not on. And it will have to change very, very soon, because we're losing our cheap oil.
It's a big one, I realize.
That's sure a big one, but even for organic farmers like us. We are still oil farmers, as I call it. We still use a lot of fossil fuel. If you take the farmer away, the diesel, you know, the fossil fuel, nothing works. The fertilizer is fossil fuel. Then the pesticide is fossil fuel. Then the transport, the machines, the tractor, the storage, and so on. Everywhere is oil. Everything is dripping off oil. And we know it's an unrenewable resource. It's coming to an end. And it's actually destroying the planet. So we better find new ways of being more sustainable on farms. But then if we can't use the machine, we would have to go back to manpower. And we do have manpower. You know, there's one energy increasing every day. It's manpower. But we can't use it because we haven't got the income to pay these people. Or we haven't got the skills anymore. People do not know how to grow food, how to look after animals, and how to behave out in the on the farm.
It's a big gap there, isn't there? Mm. And of course... support, it's very difficult to get support from the government or anybody other than, shall we say, the Permaculture Association itself and the Organics Association, but they're not what you say, cashed up like a large combine or corporation.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's unfortunate, especially here in New Zealand. But in some countries in Europe, it's really fantastic. If you look at Sweden, Austria, Denmark, they have got... Sweden has got 90% of their production now organic, which is very high. Austria has got 10% organic farms. That's about 25,000 farms, totally organic. New Zealand hasn't got even 1%. Clean, green New Zealand cannot afford to go organic and clean and produce healthy food because of our export. We're totally relying on our export, and that can be, of course, only be done in massive monoculture, and then you need the chemical help to be able to do that. And that's where we fall over as an organic nation. We have this dream to have an organic nation by 2020. So the organic movement in New Zealand is struggling really hard to make people aware what a wonderful potential this country has. You know, we are so ideal, one of the best countries in the world to be able to produce clean food because of our uniqueness, you know. geographically wonderful, isolated from all the pollution and problems from other nations. And then we have this wonderful climate here. We can do practically anything, grow practically, you know, subtropicals to all the northern hemisphere stuff, and even grain as well. But we have to change our practices and become more sustainable. At the moment, we go the other way with irrigation, for instance, huge irrigation systems in the South Island, and the water is diminishing, you know, it's disappearing. The groundwater is, the levels are sinking, and contamination, of course, happens already with oversupply of nitrogen, so we have nitrification of our water, serious problems. And I'm not blaming the farmer, because the farmer is pushed against the wall, and he has to push the animal, push the land to be able to survive in this market system, because it's all boom and bust, boom and bust. Each time it goes through a cycle, the farmer suffers, the community suffers, the environment suffers. And the real cost of farming is not paid by the consumer when he consumes, or he or she consumes the food. It's actually externalized. This externalized cost don't show up. There's no true costing system. So they externalize the cost, and then everything suffers, you know, the environment.
I hear that there's a Canadian who's involved in trying and putting in place a true system of costing that ties in the use of water in a product and the use of oil. But again, the economic system of the Western world, and particularly back home here in New Zealand, still doesn't want to have a look at new systems. We're not innovative in that particular area.
No, true costing is very unpopular, because then people, any accountant would see our system is so flawed, it's actually geared for exploitation, make a buck, run, and leave a mess behind. We are not willing to take responsibility for our full action. We're consuming this planet to death slowly, because we are so ignorant or laid back, or we just don't want to give up our luxury materialism, you know. That's some people, they think they can buy happiness. Shopping is now a thing, you know, people get enjoyment from. Consuming and throwing it away, you know, like getting cheap products from China, low quality, and just transferred, you know, it's a throwaway society, transferred into a waste heap. In a waste dump. It's really sad. I mean, what are we doing to our future generations?
Well, that's the basis, really, in for this program, is that we have to look at what we're doing for the future of children and grandchildren. And we're looking for solutions, Joe, and we've come to you to ask.
Well, hopefully I'm the right person, because in permaculture we have a say, the problem is the solution. We are very solution focused, because I know people always approach me when they come for a visit. They say, I have a problem. That's the first thing they say. Well, then I say, well, it looks like, but it's up to you. Look for a solution and the problem is gone. Most of the time the problem is in the head. And we do have solutions. Of course, we can't do it alone. It's a collective thing. We need a paradigm shift of totally different thinking of cooperation instead of exploitation and competition. We have to cooperate with nature, we have to cooperate with our people and everything living around us, because we are part of the web of life. We are not dominant. Sure, we behave like that. We think we are the gods and we can do anything on this planet, but it will backfire, and it does backfire. You look around what happens to people now. I mean, mental health and the health in general, obesity, you know, and mental health especially worries me with young people and the drugs and the alcohol and the violence. So we need a new culture. And for me, for the last 25 years, I do nothing else than permaculture. And our ethics, I really like them, and I can live up to it. And it's earth care, people care, and fair share, we call it. Care for the earth, care for the people, and share the surplus and limit consumption. We have to limit consumption. This is a finite place, this earth, planet Earth. And Homo sapiens has to recognize this. It's not all here for us. It's here. This is a place for all life, and that's how we that's where we come from in permaculture.
As to translate this into the realms of the political field, it's if you go to Queen Street, you'll still find one rubbish bin for everything, when there could be five chutes, one for paper, one for plastic, one for aluminium, one for food, and etc. And throw all this particular waste down these chutes. But we're not doing it even at a very basic level. Mm. And so, well, can I ask to move on, how is permaculture growing in New Zealand?
It is growing slowly because we are very complacent people here and relaxed, and she'll be right, mate. And it's growing in other countries a bit faster. I wish I would see a bit of faster growth here in New Zealand. But we're doing all right. There's quite a few places and quite a few good teachers that teach overseas now because we're very much in demand. We're short of permaculture teachers. I could just leave my farm here and just could keep on teaching all over the world. And I've just been teaching in Turkey, and they just asked me to set up a complete new permaculture movement in Turkey. But I can't do it because I love to be here, and I'm a farmer and a grower and a gardener. But the teaching is so important. If we don't get it right soon, we get in a bigger mess, and certain messes cannot be cleaned up because it's gone, or it's gone too far, and it cannot be reversed. So I'm a bit concerned, yeah, that government does so little. But then this kind of life that we live is perhaps not so attractive for people that totally believe in happiness, you know, is in consumption.
Sort of caught in this one, really, aren't we? Because we want to give people freedom, but when you do, they just seem to want to, as you say, consume more and more and more without thinking or looking at the waste stream as a result. I know some people are talking about consumption tax, others are talking a waste packaging tax.
Yes.
And so these are ones that are most probably will be looked at, but as you say, who's going to be the initiator of these ideas?
Not a politician, because politicians can't make this decision. If they do, they immediately vote it out. They're goners. They have to go along with globalization and the capital. The way we function now in our monetary system, you have to borrow money, you have to pay interest, and then you have to pay the interest. And as long as we do this, of course, there's no way out. And the politician cannot make this decision, because politicians are actually, I want to be very bluntly here, they're just puppets in parliament now, because what happened when we had the GATT agreement, we signed away our sovereignty. We are totally now committed to certain treaties we have, and people can, or our politician cannot decide anymore what New Zealanders want. The capital, the foreign capital, tells us what to do and how to live. And I find this very frightening. So I believe very much in people power and taking decision-making back to the community level, small units, small communities, making decisions over their resources, their place, and what should happen. So that's why I'm quite involved with local government, especially in my district here in Rodney, north of Auckland. And it's frightening how little we can actually influence the processes. Sure, they talk about democracy and have all sorts of processes to make submissions, but what is the outcome? They are not binding. You can advise or tell them what you would like to see, but they still decide. You know, and our decision makers are so badly educated, some of them, or their awareness is so low about ecological systems. And they promote growth, you know, and destruction and overconsumption. And I'm quite alarmed that our decision makers have so little understanding of sustainability. Everybody talks about sustainability, but what do they actually mean? Have a closer look. They promote totally unsustainable things.
if you could get a number of these politicians and put them in a shuttle out in space to have a look at the planet, then they would have a different viewpoint, because I know that when John Glenn first went up, or when Gagarin, of course,
that's right,
the air was a lot clearer. Now, when the space shuttle astronauts, they sign an agreement that they're not allowed to comment on anything from up in space, there was a case many years ago where one shuttle pilot went up, I think in the early 80s, and he didn't go up again until the 90s, and he saw a huge difference in the pollution around the planet, and because he was told he'd signed an agreement, he was not allowed to comment on it. And this is a crime against humanity.
Yeah, it's a lot of cover-up, of course. Lucky us, the permaculture movement is global now, and we have people practically in all countries of the world, so we get a lot of good information, reliable information that is not coming from the press, that is totally filtered and perhaps sometimes manipulated, or most of the time manipulated. So we are really lucky, and we have alarming information, of course, that is not taken up by the ordinary mass media. And you mentioned chooks before with the bird flu. You know, there's typically hype in the media, perhaps panic, but it is a serious thing too, especially for me here. I've been confronted with this issue quite a while now in Europe. 3 months ago, they had a crisis meeting there when I was there, and it is an issue that we have to look at. But it's only one of it, you know. We really have to become more holistic in our approach. And also, as you said, the observation. You don't have to go out in space to look back. Just go anywhere. Look at your roadside. Look in your garden. Look at your children. Look at animals. And you will see there's, in certain areas, a crisis coming on, or is already there. If you look at the trench resistance in New Zealand, quite a few farms already coming to the end with any of those trenches, or look at antibiotics, that's another example. So we're coming to the crisis point in many, many areas, and all together with a crisis like the bird flu, and it would really have a domino effect. It's quite amazing. But I'm not a person that wants to make scary statements. I'm just a realist, and I always like to be proactive and not reactive, because once you become reactive, you react. It's a knee-jerk reaction most of the time, and government is really good in that. So I love to look ahead, plan sustainable, and prepare yourself. I've done a bit of work with civil defense. That's another issue that I involve. Permaculture does involve the permaculture design. Even has got in the curriculum one subject. It's called planning for catastrophe. That can be bushfires or floods or bird flu or anything really. But it's very worthwhile to have this kind of education. Unfortunately, mainstream education totally fails in this line.
So how would you suggest for listeners to move towards a permaculture state of mind, bearing in mind that some people will be living in the city, others may have a little plot of land, which most probably is organic anyway, but a lot of people would be wanting to know, what's their first step?
Yeah, the first step would be, perhaps, it doesn't matter where you are, the first step would be get in contact with permaculture people, go to their field days or look at permaculture places, do a course, do a workshop. There's so many things offered. Of course, these days, the best is, of course, go on the net, and then under permaculture you have so much coming, and then hook into it. And once you're hooked, I have to put a warning out, it is actually contagious, and once you're somehow, you have the bug, you can't get rid of it, because you start taking responsibility. And the good news is that urban permaculture is functioning fantastic in so many places all over the world. And keep in mind that New Zealand, New Zealand has got a high urban population. It's actually 86%, just as much as in Japan, urban people. These people do not actually grow food, and they could because they have wonderful gardens in New Zealand, green cities like Auckland. You have all these ornamentals in there that you can't eat. And if the supermarket falls over, the power goes off, no food coming. And you could easily survive with a nice garden that is productive. And you could even sell surplus to neighbors and so on. And I would love to see urban permaculture spreading fast because we may need it in future if we have blackouts or other problems. People can always rely on food at home because the storage of food is really bad in this country. I come from Austria. You know, we are really we have a squirrel mentality. We have a cellar. We fill it up with food, you know, for the long cold winters. Here, the buildings don't have storage room. It's only fridge and freezer that you have to top up once a week. And if the supermarket can't deliver, you're stuffed. I mean, this is really a weak system. We have to start looking differently at our life and our consumption, as I said before.
Well, even from a basic point of view, for summer, I mean, we're in a situation right now, October, where we can get our veggies in, particularly our salad veggies, tomatoes, radishes, and beans, etc. So you can graze. I enjoy grazing, just going down to the garden, and I can pick it up and take it back to the house, and in 5 minutes it's all chopped up or ready to eat on the table. And this is where we get our vitality.
That's it. Fresh food straight out of the garden. Each time you pick a lettuce or some vegetables, vitamins start disappearing straight away. So it is really important to consume fresh food. And then, as I said before, no food miles on it. No packaging. You have no waste because you can return everything through the worm farm again or in your compost heap, whatever is waste. Actually, we don't call it waste. In permaculture, we have a zero waste approach. We really go for zero waste design. And in our design system, we always look for the lowest entropy. You know, the second law of thermodynamics, entropy. And that's really important. Keep the entropy as low as possible or eliminate it if you can. That's why we are cyclic thinkers. We recycle everything. And you mentioned before the waste. We should recycle more. There's a danger in that too because recycling really means something else than people understand. You cannot actually recycle paper or plastic because recycling means you take something, you use it, and then you put it back where it came from. You can't do this with aluminium or with plastic. You're not taking the plastic back to Saudi Arabia, put it under the sand and wait 4 million years until you have oil again. That would be recycling. You see, on my farm, the food comes off the land, we go to the composting toilet, and then it gets recycled back out again, and in a few years' time, it's food again. People perhaps do not understand that, and they will probably find it offensive, but that's the way it is. Everything dying in nature becomes food for something lower. There is no waste in nature. Waste was invented by the limited brains of humans. There is no waste. No ecological system knows waste, except humans in their arrogance and their ignorance.
Yes, I've seen how if you have a lion take an antelope after the lion eats, then the hyena, then after the hyena, the jackals, and finally the birds and the ants and the microbes, and there's no waste.
That's it. Yeah, it comes back as fertility again.
Yes.
And that's so important. Once we teach in schools cyclic thinking instead of linear thinking, everything is linear. It's a throwaway society. We mine something, use it, and then throw it away. It becomes pollution and waste. And that's totally, totally unsustainable. And that's a big challenge, of course, if you talk to an economist that everything is built on consumption. But they have to keep on growing the economy because of interest payment. Banks create money out of thin air, and they have to get that money somehow real. And that's how we pay back the interest. That's really the cause of all the problem with would be really lying there in the economics of our money, of our values. And to change that, I think you're taking on the whole system. And for that, we are not enough people yet. Only crisis perhaps could change it for a short time, and then it would creep back again, because I think greed is just such a powerful thing in us.
Mm. Yes, yeah, predominant at the moment. Yes, well, Joe, what is your dream? If you could set up a dream.
Well, my dream is that the future generations have got more sense, and hopefully we don't go too far in my lifetime. And well, the dream is, my dream is really to turn people around and make them more sustainable, you know, get them to a point where they can see this is not sustainable the way we live, and make changes, because a few greenies or a few permaculture people cannot save the planet. We can only do it together, and it would have to be on all levels. And I don't know how this can happen, but I can keep on dreaming, of course, and it's important to have dreams. And many times in my life, dreams became true, and it's actually quite frightening. Watch out what you dream, because it might become true. Yeah? I never thought that my place here, Rainbow Valley Farm in Marikana, would be such a nice, attractive and productive place after 18 years. But I kept on dreaming, and it looks fantastic, especially around spring now. It's wonderful. But then I'm not a blind person. I can see the problems. You see, my bees with the varroa mite, then all sorts of other problems we have with losing the seasons. So I have to keep on inventing ideas, new ideas, and coping with climate change. It's quite a traumatic change up here. We're losing the seasons, and some of my fruit, or especially I'm thinking now of the hazelnuts of Europe. I've got hazelnuts here. They would need more frost. I haven't got any frost anymore. Warm winters, so I'm losing the hazelnuts. But then the bananas do better, the subtropicals, you know, the pawpaws and papacos and so on. So we always make the best out of it, and that's so good about permaculture. We're so diverse. If we lose something, we gain in other areas.
Yes, well, this whole weather thing, I've been noticing it last night. Ended up sleeping under a sheet, and this is October. Never had that before.
Mm.
So I can understand. Are there any other permaculture farms around the Auckland area that people can go to?
Yeah, there are small movements, urban permaculture movements in Auckland. Nothing really bigger. There's the Earth Song Eco-Village or housing community in Swanson. They have permaculture gardens there, and also their building biology is based on permaculture principles. Then we have another eco-village in Kaiwaka, north of Auckland, that was built up on permaculture principles and design. Yes, there's not much really around, but we are alive, yes. And some permaculture people are not public people. They work hard just for themselves, for their families, and for their communities, and they're not so outgoing like me, and I'm a bit of a rebel rouser sometimes, and challenge people, especially politicians. And it's nice to be on your program and reach perhaps a few people and wake them up, or encourage them and inspire them to do a different lifestyle, you know, more sustainable life.
Well, you mentioned about you're looking for teachers.
Mm.
Joe, if we had, say, some people who have had some sort of farming or horticultural gardening experience, this could be possibly a whole new future for them if they went in, learnt
yes.
the skills, and then took the skills overseas. Here is an export industry
mm-hmm.
for New Zealand.
Definitely.
The knowledge economy, that really we've got so many people who want to be outdoors,
mm-hmm.
who really like nature, but haven't been able to find this particular I wouldn't call it a career option.
But it is actually a career option. I call it a career option because what you can do, you can go through this whole process of a permaculture education. You start off with a basic design course, which is a course of 2 weeks, a very intensive course. After that, you can start working on a diploma. Like I've got a diploma for permaculture teaching. And you can teach, it's an international one, you can teach in all countries of the world. You can go anywhere. And the job opportunity is there. I get very well paid in Asia and Japan or in Europe. Fantastic pay. It's actually more or less my main income now to go in winter, in the New Zealand winter to Europe, which is summer there, and teach there. This is fantastic. And unfortunately, I like to be at home and work on the farm. And I'm not very good in flying anymore because I'm totally aware of the impact that I have by hopping in a plane. You see, my ecological footprint on the farm is probably one of the best that you can find in New Zealand. But as soon as I hop in a plane, my ecological footprint is out the window.
Yes.
And that's really frightening.
I agree.
Yep.
Yeah, so you've got the smallest ecological footprint.
Yeah, I think so. I like to think.
Do you use horses, just by the way, to...
No, we only have house cows. I had a draft horse in the beginning, only 3 years. Our soil here is so heavy clay and badly drained, and the horse does a lot of damage. I've got a very fragile system here. It compacts very easy. That's why I don't use the tractor, and even a horse would be too much. But then... of course, a horse would be the solution, but I haven't got the pasture for it to sustainably feed a horse so it can work hard. You need quite a bit of grain to keep a horse working hard.
Yes.
And I couldn't grow the oats here because it's not the right place. So with draft animals, I'm no good here.
And tell me, with the earthworms, how can you get earthworms to... break up that clay if you don't?
Oh, yes. We have had fantastic success here. The soil, I show it to people sometimes. And recently there was a program on television, Country Calendar, and you could see all my worms. I inoculated the whole farm. I've been growing worms or farming worms for over 15 years. And this year I'm starting to teach actually my district here for the district council, show people how to farm with worms. So most of our wastes and whatever, sometimes I actually just give them lawn clippings with other bits and pieces and then the telephone book, and that even keeps them going. And then we harvest them and we distribute them all over the farm. But I have got a fantastic worm count now on the farm, and these worms loosen up this little bit of topsoil, and then they go also into the clay slowly and start mixing the topsoil, the humus layer, with the clay layer. And it's fantastic when you see this, when you go in with a spade and have a look over 18 years, the progress is amazing. And we're also creating humus here a lot because I grow what we call biomass plants, the fast-growing trees, shrubs, and Ethiopian bananas, and we turn all those plants into humus. And the way I do this, I get the carbon out of the air with the photosynthesis into the plant, and then the plant gets composted and turns into soil again. So what we do, instead of eroding soil and losing soil, we're actually building up soil. And in some parts in my orchard and my gardens, it's amazing how much we have built up in 18 years by just getting carbon out of the air. And with the process of composting and with the worms, we turn around and make soil again healthy, fertile, and loose, and the structure of the soil is beautifully crumbly where the worms are active. And vermicast is one of the best fertilizers for us organic farmers and growers because it's a very balanced fertilizer. Just everything there, the trace elements, minerals, just as the plant needs it. And it's available straight away. Wonderful.
And composting, composting and also mulching. These are the key ones now.
Yep.
As we go into dry summers.
Yes.
Do you do a lot of...
All mulched. There is actually, in permaculture, we say no bare soil. We cannot afford to have bare soil because nature does not want any bare soil. You can see yourself, you disturb soil somewhere, what happens? the healing plants come immediately and cover it over. Those are the weeds. We don't call them weeds in permaculture. We call them healing plants, and they are wonderful. They heal. It's like the skin on your body, you know. You have a scratch, and immediately it will, you know, cover over, and those are the weeds, you know, that's on the land. They do the same job, heal the planet. I've traveled a lot all around the world, and I look at disastrous areas and eroded and degraded and destroyed land, and I immediately have hope when I see some weeds there. But unfortunately, New Zealand, with the history that we have here, we see weeds always as bad. And it's unfortunate. We have a holy war against weeds. And what these weeds actually do, showing us that we have done everything wrong in the last 150 years, and now nature tries to heal over and create biomass and with photosynthesis. And what do? We have a holy war and spray a never-ending war that cannot be won, because we this is the wrong management. It's not natural what we do with our land.
It's a continuing story with that. I do agree, but I feel that what you're doing, Joe, is you're definitely putting a stake in the ground. You're putting
virtually.
That's right. We have to live the example, and
walk the talk. I say it's no good. We have too many talkers like me. I'm talking here now for ages, but it is also important to communicate. But the working example is the most impressive one I notice with people. Even skeptic people sometimes change their attitude when they see something is working. So working examples, we have to get the people out there. Start somewhere and show we can do better, we can do it more sustainable.
Very true. Joe, I'm going to get you to finish shortly with a little uplifting story to tell us.
That's all uplifting.
Yes. Well, that's it. To realize the challenges we've got facing us and to mobilize the people, that's a big one, because a lot of people are locked in on survival and really, they we haven't been able to get what you call a big think tank, an ecological think tank together of the top brains in New Zealand.
We do have them. Yeah, we do have those top brains here. But there's one thing that I think people do not listen. If I look at my career as a 40-year-old greenie and environmentalist and activist, there's one pattern. First, you get laughed at and ridiculed, you know, when you come up with a new idea.
Yes.
Then you get attacked if you don't give up. And once you get attacked, actually you have won, because the third stage, the third point is it becomes self-evident, or even it becomes law. When I look at the Resource Management Act, lots of things that I was nearly knocked over on, you know, and laughed at 15 years ago is now in the Resource Management Act. Eventually we will have to obey natural laws, and there's no way past those natural laws. So, yes.
Yep, that's all.
But it's, of course, where do we start? I always say start somewhere, small steps, and make sure they get bigger, and there's always a starting point, never too late. Because if we say it's too late, then we have no hope anymore. And it's nothing more sad than just to meet young people who say there's no future, there's no hope. This really worries me. I do meet those people. Some are actually suicidal. And this is what makes me really sad, because this planet is so beautiful and so fascinating, and our life is so short to explore and understand just a tiny bit of this web of life, of this beautiful place, what we call planet Earth.